This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with James Goodale, a well-known First Amendment lawyer. He worked for the New York Times back in the 1960s as the chief attorney when the Times was involved in two celebrated cases, New York Times versus Sullivan and the Times versus the United States regarding the Pentagon Papers. He's written his memoirs, and we'll talk with him about fighting for the press and also the latest regarding the president's acknowledgement that the administration spied on reporters. And we'll hear from Holcomb Noble, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, also from the New York Times, who says that Dick Cheney should be tried for war crimes, the former vice president. And Randy Hayden with the Louisiana Family Forum on a major adoption initiative in Louisiana. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us online at inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with James Goodale. He represented the New York Times in the landmark Pentagon Papers case when the Nixon White House attempted to stop the Times from publishing top-secret documents about the Vietnam War leaked by Daniel Ellsberg. He has written about his life and times, and those times go back a long ways. He was involved in the famous case, New York Times versus the United States, and he is a man who's written about his experience with the press, calling Fighting for the Press the inside story of the Pentagon Papers and other battles. Good morning, James Goodale.
Good morning. Glad to be on the show.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and you were getting much attention last week in The Advocate in Baton Rouge. We had a column from Clarence Page, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, writer, who has been on the show several times, and he talks about your book, Fighting for the Press, and it comes at a time as a new wave of leak-plugging questions is in full bloom. What's your read on what's going on right now with the Obama administration?
Well, I think we've come the full circle. For those who can remember the Pentagon Papers, it was a great leak case in which, as you point out, the Nixon administration wanted to stop the New York Times from publishing a leak. And here we are today in the last 2 weeks with two big leak cases. As your listeners know, one is AP and another one involving James Rosen, which Fox News calls Rosengate, and they're pretty outrageous examples of leak plugging. So what I've reluctantly concluded is that Obama's getting close, if he's not past him with respect to dealing with the First Amendment and this sort of leak and publication matters.
This is a difficult time for many who were supportive on him on various other fronts. When it comes to the First Amendment, the people who are left of center, liberals, they generally are stalwarts of the First Amendment. And here's a president who is popular with Democrats and those on the left side of the political spectrum, for the most part, who has now done something that is not popular with that group for the most part. So what kind of political implications are there, if any?
Well, I think that politically he probably can abandon his liberal Democrats on this one because they've got nowhere to go. And he probably has got majority support from the rest of the political spectrum, although I will point out that when you mistreat a Fox News reporter, you've been to get fire from both directions. But I think implicitly, I can't say this explicitly, he's made a calculation, maybe even subconsciously, that with respect to national security and the press, he's going to be tough. And that and if they don't like it, in a sense, it's too bad. Now, we know that he gave a big speech a couple of days ago. Was it Thursday or Friday of last week? And he had to address this this question, and he said what he was going to do was he's going to let the press talk it over with the Attorney General. I don't think much is going to come out of that. So I think the bottom line is he's just going to ride it through. And by the way, I think that the Rosengate, if I can call it that, incident is really pretty terrible. And in my book, I point out we've got WikiLeaks coming down the line where the same issues coming up. So I don't see much bright sunshine here for the First Amendment.
In his 20s, our guest James Goodale set up the legal department at the New York Times. He became the first general attorney for the Times in 1963, 50 years ago. And a year later, the Supreme Court decided in New York Times versus Sullivan, 9-0, unanimously, in favor of the Times, overturning a libel conviction and establishing modern rules for libel for public figures. Now, in that case, by the way, Sullivan was represented by Richard Nixon, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't. Nixon represented another great press case, but not this one.
I thought he worked on the appeal, but I'll tell
you. No, I don't know. Okay. He worked on the appeal of another case, but
okay.
That's okay.
But anyway, yeah. He was certainly involved in the next one, the Pentagon Papers case. But
that's for sure.
But the Sullivan case established the rules for who's a public figure, right, and actual malice and that sort of thing. Weren't those the precedents that were set in that case?
Right. Well, that was the first New York Times case, and it was followed by the Pentagon Papers case. The first case was quite important because for your listeners who all live in the South was a different place then, and several libel verdicts had come down in Alabama that if they had been effected, that is to say, if the Sullivan and the others had won them, it would have bankrupted the Times. The verdicts for that time were very, very high. So this was an important case for the New York Times, and it went to the Supreme Court and said for the first time, hey, listen, the First Amendment applies to a libel case.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your listeners may find it hard to believe that that was so, but it was so. And the Supreme Court came down with this great libel case, which protected the Times and gave reporters terrific rights. You know, I would think that Obama would be in favor of that case. Where Obama makes a mistake is he goes over these national security cases and he can't, he can't think straight, see straight or whatever. But the Sullivan case was a great case in a string of a couple of First Amendment victories for the New York Times in a short period of time.
Well, the Times last week pounded away at the Obama administration in an editorial, and I'll read a few words, saying, the Obama administration, which has a chilling zeal for investigating leaks and prosecuting leakers, has failed to offer a credible justification for secretly combing through the phone records of reporters and editors of the Associated Press in what looks like a fishing expedition for sources in an effort to frighten off whistleblowers. The Justice Department is pursuing at least two other major press investigations, including one believed to be focused on David Sanger's reporting in a book and in the Times on an American-Israeli effort to sabotage Iranian nuclear works. Those tactics will not scare us off in the AP, but they could reveal sources on other stories and frighten confidential contacts vital to coverage of government. Those words from the New York Times, and we have a man who started the legal department at the Times about a half century ago, James Goodale, who's written a new book about his life and times in the First Amendment, and we will talk with him if you'd like to join the conversation in our remaining time, 297-5633 for James Goodale. His book is Fighting for the Press, the Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles. How significant was the Pentagon Papers decision?
Well, the Pentagon Papers decision was extremely important, because it stopped censorship. What Nixon did is he went into court and he tried to stop the Times from publishing. And he succeeded for quite a while until the case went to the Supreme Court for, say, about 10 days. So when the Supreme Court came down and said, no, you can't censor the press, that violates the First Amendment, that is an historic case. Now, where I hate to think 50 years later, but we are at a later period of time, and the battle now is not so much censorship, it's what happens after you publish. So So if you look at the two cases you talked about a few seconds ago, AP and Rosen, those are cases where the government's coming in and saying, I want to know the source of the leaks of something that already has been published. And what the government is saying with respect to the Fox News reporter, James Rosen, is, hey, you're just as criminal as the guy who leaks. And that's never, never been successfully said in court before. That's a new precedent. One of the reasons I wrote my book was, hey, let's look at the Pentagon Papers. Nixon went down because he was too enamored of national security. Now we have Obama with a similar love, but he's changing the law, not before publication, but after publication. People may say, so what? But it means you, sir, if I had classified information, by talking to me would be committing a crime. So I say, hey, let's learn the lessons of the Pentagon Papers. Don't mess around with national security classification in extreme. You're going to get in trouble, President Obama. And coming down the line is this case involving Julian Assange. And I wrote this all before the stories that come out the last couple of weeks. And I said, wake up, American public. Wake up the press. He's going to do the same thing to Julian Assange, who owned the website WikiLeaks, that he did to Rosen. He's going to make him a criminal co-conspirator. And this is terrible. Now, I don't know if I've woken up the press or not, but they seem to be a little more interested after Rosen than they were when you say WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, which draws sympathy from practically no one.
Right, but when you pick on Fox News, then certainly the right wing becomes more engaged.
And the right wing,
but on engaged. This, I'm not sure it's a right or left issue. It's just an American issue. First Amendment applies to everybody. And James Goodale, our guest, not only was the prime lawyer for the Times in the 60s and early 70s, he's taught at Yale Law School from 77 to 80, New York University School of Law, 83 to 86, and at the Fordham Law School, 1986 to the present. Charles on North Foster, please be brief. Charles, you're on with James Goodale. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, James. My concern is with the press self-censorship. We have here a case in Louisiana where we have two different standards for private schools and public schools, and I couldn't get a newspaper in New Orleans, Baton Rouge, or Shreveport to touch it. So what can we do about this self-censorship and this progressively conservative approach?
All right, well, that's a different issue, but one does the,
well, the same sort of thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, basically, the question is, how do you get the press attention, and so they don't either ignore you, or if they know about you, decide not to pay any attention to you. And I feel a lot of sympathy with the caller, because I've been fighting an uphill battle with this book. It came out officially April 30th, but the way the world works on the Internet now, there's an Internet pre-publication life that began 30 days before. So we're looking at 2 months of me sounding the clarion call. And what do you do to get the press interested? I think it's a very difficult question. And so I think the answer is more call-in shows like the call that was just made. You got to beat on the press to pay attention to you. As much as I love the press and have made my living from representing them, I think that the mainstream press is probably like the rest of us. They sort of have an expected view of the world, and when you challenge it, it's very hard to break through.
297-5633, we'll take a short break with James Goodale. He's taught for over 30 years at Yale, NYU, and Fordham Law Schools, and his memoirs, entitled Fighting for the Press, The Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles, published by the City University of New York Journalism Press last month, actually April 30th, and it is out and about, and certainly pertinent at this time when the president is under fire for spying on the Associated Press and maybe intimidating other reporters such as James Rosen. We'll talk more with James Goodale when we return. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is your toll-free number wherever you may be. James Goodale's the guest. His book is Fighting for the Press. He created a First Amendment Bar Association for attorneys representing media companies and conducts a continuing education seminar at the Practicing Law Institute on Communications Law. And communications law evolves like everything else, and right now we have some cases that quite likely will result in some kind of litigation, and it involves, of all people, President Obama. A story that was forwarded to me by a listener, and I've seen this before, but it is pertinent. A 1958 article in the Saturday Evening Post is responsible for President Obama's father coming to the United States. If it hadn't been for the article, Obama's father would never have come to Hawaii. He certainly wouldn't have married his American wife, and his son, our president, would never have been born either here or anywhere else. So it was the media who created, in some way, the president of the United States.
That's a great story.
Now, speaking of the Saturday Evening Post, yeah. Before New York Times versus Sullivan, they had the famous Bear Bryant story, right, which caused them a lot of grief.
Yeah, who remembers the Saturday Evening Post? But boy, they had a lot of problems. One of the great influences on my life was the Saturday Evening Post. I used to deliver it as a newsboy, but B, more important, and why I'm talking about it now, is that they ran a story before the Pentagon Papers case about an invasion of Cuba called the Bay of Pigs invasion. I think most listeners probably remember that. And the story told exactly what everybody had said to everyone else within the White House with respect to that invasion. And all of that was classified. And I'm saying to myself, reading that, this is even before I thought about the Pentagon Papers, how can it be so much leaked material gets published? And the answer is the government leaks all the time because everything is classified. And when it helps them, which in the case I just talked about, made the government look good in terms of their decision-making process, they'll let it out. But if they don't like it, they'll get you in jail. So I think listeners probably say, hey, go get those guys. They leak classified information. But, you know, Obama is classified like 17 million documents. Everything's classified. So for those who want to write about government, they're going to talk to people who have access to classified information. And under Obama's rules, they're going to end up like James Rosen. And his phone was tapped. They think his parents' phone was tapped. They followed him around. And he's just trying to get a good story for Fox News.
Dorothy on Goodwood. Dorothy, good morning. You're on the air with James Goodale.
Good morning. It's good to talk to you, James. I have a question about the Julian Assange case. Do you think Bradley Manning might be the hook that they use to prevent any more WikiLeaks cables since they couldn't get Julian Assange?
Yes, I do. I might say initially that when you think of Bradley Manning, he leaked tons and tons of stuff. I mean, clearly shouldn't have done it. And then you think about a Julian Assange, and a lot of people don't think he's the most attractive figure in the world. And I might share their opinion, though I defend him to the end of the world. We have two people who are involved in an important principle. And I think the government, to answer your question directly, is trying to throw the book at Bradley Manning, overdoing it in a certain way. And I think that they're trying to make an example out of him so no one will ever do it again. And at the same time, it's my theory that what they're trying to prove in that case will be useful for any case against Julian Assange. Now, the Bradley Manning case, hey, all listeners, pay attention to that because it's going to start next week. And it's what you want to look for is what the government is trying to trying to prove and how bad they're trying to make him look. He's already agreed to go away for 20 years, and in my view, that'd be enough. The government wants to put him away for life. Now, should that happen? And they want to use Aiding the Enemy Act. That's never been used in a leak case. It's got a death penalty provision in it, which would mean they're not going to use the death penalty here, but it could be used against our host here, Mr. Jim. If he were to leak something that he shouldn't. The government's overdoing it. Obama's overdoing it. They really want to get Manning and put him away forever. Then they want to use, in my humble opinion, the evidence that comes out there against Julian Assange if they can catch him. He's in the Ecuadorian embassy right now, and no one can touch him.
Well, another listener, Sophie, notes that the president may have made a political calculation that the perception of him cracking down on evildoers is better than the, at least more of an advantage than the perception that he's being tough on media types.
I think that is correct, because the being tough on media types isn't going to help his perception. But I think that that is true. I think it is also probably true. He's what I call a true believer in national security, but I think that he knows that the perception of that is not going to hurt him, generally speaking.
Well, we thank you, and it'd be nice to talk with you again. This is something that I don't think this story is going away. I think it's going to be around for a while, James.
I agree.
And it's something that could involve some more court issues, perhaps litigation that could be precedent developing. So
yeah, no, I'm really worried about it, and I've got a couple of chapters on my book that raises the clarion call about it. I'm really worried about it, as a matter of fact.
The book is Fighting for the Press, the Inside Story of the Pentagon Papers and Other Battles, from James Goodale, who's been on the front lines of the First Amendment now for over 50 years. Thank you, James.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now joining us, also from New York City, is Holcomb Noble, whose friends call him Hulk, former investigation editor at the New York Times, who led two teams to back-to-back Pulitzer Prizes. He has written a book called Cheney's War Crimes, The Reign of a De Facto President. We're talking about Dick Cheney, the man who was Vice President of the United States from 2001 to 2009. Good morning, Hulk Noble.
Good morning.
Well, Hulk, dovetailing from one segment to the other, the Cheney issues, do they involve First Amendment considerations as well?
Well, to some extent, yeah. Cheney was very tough on people who disagreed with him, and he wiretapped, and I think that's not my biggest gripe.
Well, I know what your biggest gripe is, but the media were complicit in sending the United States to war against Iraq, and that includes the New York Times, by the way, leading up to the Iraq invasion. Words that were uttered by the president and the vice president and the secretary of state and the national security advisor, they were all printed in the Times and in other media outlets, and ultimately the United States went to a war under false pretenses.
Also, Mr. Tom Friedman, the columnist, said, well, he wouldn't be against the war, but we have to do it in the right way. But he eventually dropped the butt, but he never opposed the war.
No, not many people did. They either didn't say much or they were actively in favor of the war, and they were taking the word of the Bush administration. Now, did Cheney know that the administration was spewing false rhetoric leading up to war?
Well, I think so. I mean, if he didn't know, he should have known, because what he said in August 26th of 2002 was, there is no doubt that the Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. And he had doubts himself because he asked the CIA, Valerie Plame, who was a spy, part-time spy and part-time administrator in a small office at Langley at the CIA headquarters, to investigate this Niger report, which was an Italian-written report that said, that allegedly said that Saddam Hussein sought enriched uranium from Niger, and Valerie Plame investigated her, and her sent the staff of Valerie Plame in this office, this small office of counterterrorism at the CIA, suggested to her that she send her husband, who had been an ambassador to Africa, Joe Wilson. And she said, well, she recused herself. She said, if you want to send him, I can't. I that would be a conflict for me. I can't decide. So if you want to decide to send him, you can ask him, and if he agrees, and you agree, then send him.
All right. Well, we're going to try to cover as much ground with Hope Noble in our remaining time as we can. The book is Cheney's War Crimes, The Reign of a De Facto President, when Holcomb Noble left his decorated career at the New York Times, where he led two teams in year-long investigations that won back-to-back Pulitzers. He set about preparing for a project that would change how most Americans view the Bush-Cheney administration. Now, Vincent Bugliosi was on this show a few years ago. He wrote a book called George W. Bush Should Be Tried for Murder, and I'm paraphrasing the title. He believes that the president was involved in sending young Americans off to fight in a war that was ill-advised at best and perhaps calculated at worst. Do you think President or Vice President Cheney should be tried in court for actions he took while he was serving our country?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Cheney more than Bush. I mean, it was Cheney's idea. The day after 11 at the first national security meeting, which was introduced by George Tenet, the head of the CIA, as definitely coming from Afghanistan, the 9/11 attacks in Pakistan, and Cheney said, "Well, why don't we go to war against Iraq?" And to me, this was like the joke of a guy looking for the car keys that he dropped down the drain under the light instead of where he dropped them, because as Richard A. Clarke, the counterterrorism chief, said, you know, he was trying to use 9/11 to further his own agenda, because the reason he wanted to invade Iraq, and it was Cheney's initiative. Cheney was responsible for most of the decisions of the Bush administration, and he was a very powerful guy, and Bush, with his obvious weaknesses, went along, I think Cheney should definitely be prosecuted for war crimes.
The book is Cheney's War Crimes, The Reign of a De Facto President, from Holcomb Noble. The book I referenced, Vincent Bugliosi, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Now, Bugliosi said that he thought our former president should be tried and, if convicted, executed for what was done during his administration. Do you think Dick Cheney, if he were to be convicted of war crimes, should be executed?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Well, yes.
He is a man, as we've noted, when it was his time to fight in a war, he took 5 draft deferments. Does that have any relevance to the discussion we're having now about whether or not Iraq was a prudent war?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, lots of people sought deferments from the Vietnam War, which was also a stupid war. But that's irrelevant to this issue. I mean, he did decide to invade a foreign land that had no potential threat to that posed no threat to the United States. I mean, this, and he did that because he wanted continued access to its oil, with the second largest oil reserves in the world. And you know, you can't just march across Poland as Hitler did in the start of World War II. You can't just march across Iraq just because you want their oil, the Iraqis' oil. I mean, that's a war crime. And he also committed many other war crimes. I mean, every day that people were tortured, that's a war crime, and it violates 237 years of American tradition of treating humanitarian a tradition founded by George Washington.
Well, a listener also points out that Cheney shot a man in the face, Mr. Whittington, and I've noted on this show, I haven't seen one follow-up story about Whittington and how he's doing.
Well, he had a heart attack.
Yeah, I know he had a heart attack right after he was shot, but that's been several years. It would be interesting to get his take, and the vice president acknowledged that he had been drinking when he shot the man. So was he intoxicated when he shot this man in the face?
Well, I don't know.
But all of that.
But, I mean, you could say that was an accident. He certainly didn't intend to shoot him in the face, but but he did intend to torture war captives, and over again. I mean, many, many times. Every single time, somebody was tortured, get information about Yemen or whatever. They were committing a war crime, and he was the guy who was the eminence grease of anti-terrorism in the United States.
And you're saying this was all about oil?
That's why he invaded Iraq. Yes,
he said we would be greeted as liberators.
Well, he was wrong. I mean, they hated American presence. I mean, they had their own civil war, the Shiites versus Sunnis. And this was an interruption of their own war, and they resented the hell out of our being in their land, and many of the people that we arrested as terrorists in Iraq were simply opposing an illegal occupation by a foreign land. But if you want to call them the terrorists, we went and tortured them without proving their guilt.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. We'll return, spend a few more minutes with Holcomb Noble. His book is Cheney's War Crimes, The Reign of a De Facto President. We'll also hear from Randy Hayden. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. In a few moments, we'll hear from Randy Hayden, the president of Creative Communications, and has been involved with the Louisiana Family Forum on an adoption campaign, and there's been legislation that will apparently be signed into law by Governor Bobby Jindal this week. 297-5633 for our remaining segment. Holcomb Noble, two-time Pulitzer winner with the New York Times, is with us. His book is Cheney's War Crimes, The Reign of a De Facto President. Now, Holk, I know through the years you've written many of the obits in the New York Times, and I always read that page or two in the Times each day, and it's always exceptional as far as how lives are captured by the newspaper. When Dick Cheney passes away, what do you think will be in the first graph of his obituary?
I have no idea. I'm afraid it'll be too gentle. I would love to read it, but there's a law, there's a firm rule against showing anybody those advance obituaries. It was the best job I ever had. It was the most fun because Every event's obituary was a guaranteed great story, or they wouldn't choose them to do in advance. So you had all the time in the world to write as much as you wanted. It wasn't the most powerful job that I ever had, but it was the most fun.
Well, some
I don't know what they would say. I wrote an essay about Cheney for the op-ed page, and they turned it down because Maureen Dowd had written this same thing about the same time. I think the paper has really been much too favorable to Cheney and to Bush. I mean, they still talk about Bush's war against Iraq. It wasn't Bush's war. It was Cheney's war. I mean, Bush actually preferred to go after Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he said, well, I don't want to go to Iraq first. I would rather go after get bin Laden in Pakistan first. And what happened? Well, we invaded Iraq. So who was in charge?
Well, the president, you know, the president was the man who had the job, and he overruled Cheney on other matters, but he didn't.
Well, not many.
Not on this one. And you say the vice president was in violation of the U.N. Charter, national statutory law, and the U.S. Constitution, and it's all
and
detailed.
International law.
Yeah, it's all detailed in the reign of a de facto president from Holcomb Noble, who's no fan of Richard Cheney. Now, a listener did note that Cheney, prior to becoming vice president, was a defense secretary, that he wasn't some Johnny-come-lately to foreign policy. Could it be possible? Could it be possible that his intentions were good and he just made a bad call on Iraq?
No, when he was Secretary of Defense, he wrote a secret report, which probably he kept secret from his own president, calling for the world, for the U.S. military domination of the world in 1992. And he mentioned it might be, back then, he mentioned it might be necessary to invade Iraq. So he had a long history of wanting to protect oil. He was in love with oil, and you know he undercut Bush's campaign pledge to control carbon emissions because the major cause of carbon dioxide that causes global warming is the burning of oil. And, you know, so...
Well, he survived six heart attacks.
Five heart attacks.
Well,
yeah.
I read last week he was in Louisiana. He now says he's had six. One more heart attack than he had draft deferments. But but he must be a pretty tough guy.
Oh, he's a tough guy. Also a brilliant guy. He got virtually everything he wanted as de facto president. And he rose to that position from a position as vice president, which was empty of power and even anything to do. I mean, John Adams, the first vice president, said it was the most meaningless job man in his imagination ever conceived. And Lyndon Johnson went nuts over the job because he had nothing to do. And so how Cheney managed to make himself the de facto ruler of the United States is amazing.
Well,
he's a very effective guy.
I know you're fired up, and I'm sure those who read your book, if they're in accord with you, will probably also have their blood pressure rise. And we thank you for spending time with us today. The book is Cheney's War Crimes, The Reign of a De Facto President. Thank you, Holcomb Noble.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. 297-5633, and we have the very calm and composed Randy Hayden across the panel from us. And Randy is a man who is involved in various endeavors, president of Creative Communications, one of the most experienced and respected public relations practitioners in the state, an award-winning journalist. For many years, he was part of the Capitol Press Corps covering the state, and his reports were seen and heard throughout the state. And good morning to you, Randy Hayden.
Glad to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're one of those people who used to be a member of the Capitol Press Corps. I'm surprised you're not in the Gridiron Show. That seems to be kind of a hangout for people who used to be in the Capitol
Press
Corps.
Kind of does. It's the used to be's. I think it actually ought to be a performance for those that are still in the business.
You do?
Yeah, I really do. I had a wonderful time. My 5 years in the media, and still get to have good relationships with a lot of you guys and a lot of the Capitol Press Corps. But I think what you do is way different than what we do, and so you need your own outlet. And I think Gridiron's a great outlet for the media.
Well, as I wear, you wear many hats. I don't know if I wear that many, but as a former reporter, you now. A public relations practitioner and one of the best in the state, and you're doing some work for the Family Forum. What's going on regarding Family Forum and adoption?
We are, Jim. It's a volunteer effort, an issue that personally is very near and dear to me and my family, I'm excited to be a part of this. So many people look at Family Forum, and I'm not speaking on their behalf. I'm speaking on behalf of the initiative, which is Over the Edge for Adoption. And so many people have negative connotations of the churched community. And I just think it was a wonderful opportunity for Gene Mills and his organization to say, let's really put a positive spin on the things that we would like to do and like to see in the state of Louisiana. And Louisiana wants to be number one in so many areas, and we've got a governor that likes touting the good things where we are number one or near the top. And I think one of the things that we really have a realistic shot at in the near future would be having a waiting list of people for adopting children that are wards of the state. Right now, across America, there's about 100,000 children in foster care. And in Louisiana, we've got almost 500 that are waiting to be adopted right now.
So what would the Over the Edge campaign do? How would this work?
It's really kind of threefold. The first part is anybody that's been through the process, my wife and I have been through the process, have recognized that there are hurdles and impediments, and many of these are for good reason. You certainly want to connect children with the best possible parents, and they need to be vetted. You need to make sure that you've got parents and individuals that that are going to want children for all the right reasons, and that takes some time. But as we've gone through the process, there were a few things where we said we can speed this up, and we can also make it more attractive so that people would look to adopting state children. And one of those things would be, if you want to be in foster care, it takes 6 months for the state to come in and check mm-hmm. you out. Well, if you are approved for foster care after 6 months, and then you decide, boy, I sure would like to adopt that child, it takes another 6 months of the exact same process. So part of the legislation will be to help squeeze that time period so that you can tell prospective families and children that are in this pipeline, we can make this happen quickly. And speed's an important element in the adoption process.
297-5633 for Randy Hayden, who today is representing the Louisiana Family Forum on this adoption campaign. The bill will be signed by Governor Jindal. It's passed the legislature. Is that right?
It's been through the Senate. I believe it has been through the House. It may have some technical revisions. I'm not exactly sure about that. We may have to go back and just make sure that they clean up all the technical amendments to that. But right now, we are scheduled to have a news conference with Governor Jindal Friday at 1 o'clock over at the One American Place upstairs in the boardroom that they've got at the very top of One American Place.
And you say you and your wife have gone through this process?
Well, we did. Many, many years ago, we adopted a child from the state, and it was a life-changing experience for us, hopefully for our daughter as well. And we encourage it for anybody that has a heart for adoption and that sees that, mm-hmm. that there's room in their heart that can be filled outside of the traditional family.
Christy asked if same-sex couples can adopt in Louisiana.
You know, this legislation, I don't know exactly how this legislation is designed. It runs through the Department of Children and Family Services, DCFS, and they're will be provisions within current law that would address those issues.
So whatever the law is, I guess it would apply in this case. And in Louisiana, we have a lot of kids who are looking for people to adopt them, don't we?
Yeah, we absolutely do. With that almost 500 children, probably 200 have access right now in the pipeline. In other words, they're in foster care where somebody is considering adoption, or there's a family member that's considering adoption. You've got another 200 plus, however, that are waiting for somebody to come and say, I'd like to give this a shot. Mm-hmm. And so this initiative is threefold. One is, let's clear it up legislatively. Two, let's try to have a high-profile issue, a high-profile event that will bring attention to this. And then three, and the most important aspect of it will be after the fact, let's try to hook up 100 kids with 100 families.
So the 100 doesn't sound like a big number, but I guess that
if you're a child sitting in foster care, you'd love to be one of those 100.
Depending on the family, of course.
Well, that's true.
But they're well vetted, aren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely, and that will always be the case.
What kind of process did you and your wife have to go through?
You know, they check you out financially. They talk with your neighbors. They check with your employers. You go through, at the time we had to, and it may have changed by now, about 30 hours of class training that prepares you, because many of these children have mental impairments, physical problems that have to be addressed, and families sometimes aren't prepared for that. So the classes, the courses that are available for you help get parents up to speed with the particular needs of their child.
All right. Calvin asks if this is, does it only apply to children born in Louisiana?
I'm not sure about if they're born in Louisiana, but they are children that are in state custody. And right now, like I say, there's 480 plus, almost 500.
Mm-hmm. Was your daughter one of those who was in state custody?
Yeah, she was. You know, Jim, without getting too personal on the issue, when you think of adoption, you think we're going to get a cute little blonde-haired, blue-eyed infant baby daughter. And the state called us up after we had been approved for foster care and said, we've got some urgent needs. Would you mind holding this child, 8.5-year-old young lady? Would you mind keeping her over the weekend? And that's kind of how it started. We met her over the mm-hmm. weekend and said, boy, that was kind of fun. Let's do that again. And one weekend led to another weekend, and then it led into some serious consideration about adoption. And when she was 10 years old, we did adopt.
Is she blonde and blue-eyed?
She's blue-eyed. She's not blonde. But she is a beautiful young lady.
Right. And how old is she now?
She's in her 20s, a mother in her own right. And we certainly believe that the impact that she had on us was something that has encouraged me and my wife to talk about with many, many other people. And it's encouraged my mm-hmm. wife to say, I'm going to go over the edge because I'm so much a believer in this whole process.
Well, if Edwin Edwards can have a child at 86, you're young enough to do this again, aren't you?
I could do it again, and I would. I'm not sure my wife would want to go through that again. She's looking to retire from the school system and mm-hmm. looking to maybe get away from kids for a while.
Well, with so many kids needing adoptive parents, what about a man having a child at 86 years old? I guess that's his business.
I think that's wonderful. I would actually love to, you know, part of the initiative is that people get to rappel off of One American Place. And Governor Edwards would be a wonderful candidate for that. I wish he would come join us.
Well, LSU
coach Les Miles is going to do it. He'll be rappelling Thursday at 1 o'clock. Friday at 1 o'clock is the news conference. We've got Miss Louisiana participating, dozens of other volunteers, and those that are contributing to this fundraising effort mm-hmm. are participating Thursday and Friday. We encourage everybody that's got the opportunity to come on downtown and watch people experience a one-in-a-lifetime event.
Anna notes that Mary Landrieu adopted a couple of children.
She absolutely did, from a Baton Rouge facility, and we have asked her to participate, and we have every belief and encouragement that while she probably will not go over the edge, that she does support this effort.
Well, this is something that can bring people of various political stripes together, and in that respect, I guess it's a good thing.
It is. Jim, want to make sure, because I know we're a little tight on time, before we get out of here, if people have a desire for this and want more information, they can go to lafamilyforum.org or overtheedgeforadoption.com. It's got all the information available.
Okay, but thank you, Randy Hayden. Did want to note that today is the 95th anniversary of the birth in Columbia, Louisiana, of former Governor John Julian McKithen, born on this date in 1918. He died in 1999. We'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.